Hello, this is Tim Simpson, and this is my world. I am an author. I've written over 40 books that are on Audible right now, and each month I'm going to upload 2 hours of audiobooks. They'll be the first book of a series, and I hope that you enjoy it. They'll be absolutely free for you to listen, so download and enjoy.
M. Book 1. Written by Tim James Simpson. Narrated by Andrew Sims. Nightfall. Chapter 1.
Captain's Journal. This has been a most interesting voyage thus far, and it seems to have come to an end here in the Arctic. My passengers seem pleased with what they have discovered in this frozen wasteland of nothing but ice and snow. The leader of this expedition seems a queer sort of fellow, always dressed in heavy garb from neck to foot, and even his face is always fully wrapped in white bandages that seem fresh every time my eye looks upon him. It is not fully clear to me as to what it is these adventurers hope to find out here, but I feel the quicker we pull out, the happier I will be, and journal. He laid his quill down after looking over his journal. 5 months the captain and his crew have been out here searching for something unknown to them all. The ship creaks and makes all sorts of ghostly noises as the ice bumps into the old wooden hull. A man in his late 40s, who looks much older, has been the captain of this ship for many years now. His crew has always put their trust in him. That is until months of the bitter cold weather started becoming freezing, which only made the months seem longer, and still without any signs of progress, they continued forward deeper into the frozen tundra.
"Captain, we have word from shore, sir. They found it," said First Mate Starbuck, with a sound of relief following with.
"And it's about time." Captain Ahab stood up from behind his oak desk. The captain stumbled a bit from the wooden leg that replaced his natural one. "I want to see this thing for myself," he said as he limped his way around his desk to the doorway where his first mate was standing. He stopped just beside his mate.
"And this had better be worth it,"
Ahab said as he continued past his first mate and down the corridor. On the deck of the ship it was bitter cold. Men were huddled around one another for warmth as they looked out over the frozen plain. The air was like trying to breathe in sharp needles as the breeze stung the lungs of the crew. The wind gave many sailors burns on their faces that froze their beards solid. Ahab made his way to the helm of his grand ship so he could see, with the use of his spyglass, the landing party making their way back, pulling something by way of a sled. It was gliding easily behind them over the frozen white terrain.
"Mr. Owens, ready the ship to make sail,"
Captain Ahab said as he continued looking through his glass. The men struggled as they hoisted up the frozen cargo.
"This had better be worth it,"
shouted Ahab once more as the frozen piece of ice was lowered onto the deck of his ship. The chunk of ice fell with a loud clunk as the sailors jumped backwards.
"Be very careful, you idiots,"
shouted the man everyone simply referred to as Griffin, as he finished his climb up the roped ladder that hung from the side of the ship.
"What is it?"
Ahab shouted as he climbed down from his perch. Griffin fell toward the cargo, examining it. He had to see it for himself, and he had spent years researching the whereabouts of this one giant block of ice. Griffin was an odd-looking fellow. He was covered from head to toe, not an ounce of skin showing. Bandages covered his entire head, neck, and hands. Dark glasses covered his eyes.
"He seems to be okay,"
Griffin said, looking up at his companion, one who had charted this big ship with him.
"What have you brought aboard my ship?"
Ahab asked as he hobbled towards the cargo. His men stood motionless, staring at the giant block of ice.
"Well, Professor?"
asked Griffin, looking up at his companion.
"Don't worry, Captain. All is well," the one they called Professor said.
The captain approached the new cargo that lay on the deck of his ship. Ahab stopped, frozen in his tracks, as he glanced down at the piece of frozen water that lay before him.
"My lord," he said, staring in awe.
He could see into part of the ice, and what he saw froze his already chilled spine. There in the ice was a pair of eyes, dark eyes, staring back at him. Chapter 2. The December wind blew hard, knocking the snow from the treetops. The Coir Loch Mountains howled with a night breeze, but still he ran as hard as his 50-some-odd-year-old legs would carry him. The trees in the night were beating against his large-brimmed hat, knocking it to the side of his head. His face stung from the cold, red and breathing hard, he kept pushing forward, he kept running, he glanced up on occasion, and he could see the giant shadows in the sky. They were looking hard for him now, and he knew what would happen if they ever found him. For 3 years now they just kept coming after him. He could find no rest. They kept hunting him as if he was their prey. He had killed many of these would-be assassins, and now more was sent to find him. He is a fighter, and this fight is no different than all the others. He killed their father several years ago, and now all of the offspring want his blood. He is tired, he is older now, and he has been fighting alone. Rest is all that occupies his mind at the moment, but out in these dark woods it doesn't seem possible. Faint music fills the air. Am I truly losing my faculties? He thinks to himself as he listens to the sweet tranquillity of the music that seems to whisper from the trees. How far is it? He thinks as he catches his breath, but just for a moment. It is somewhere in the distance, the sound. It's the sound of violin music playing, soft music. Maybe a place to rest a while. He picks himself up off the snowy ground and pushes forward. His body screams at him. The pain was almost too much for him to bear, but he ignores it for now. Keep on the move, that's his only thought. The night was black, the moon hid behind the dark clouds of the night sky. Not even the stars were shining this night. The trees shaded the ground like evil spirits dancing around as the wind gently blew the limbs. He felt as though he was running with a blindfold on. He did not feel the hand that grabbed onto his shoulder until he was spun around.
You really think you can escape us, old man?
The half-creature, half-woman said as she slammed her newly caught prey into a tree.
You kill our master and expect nothing in return?
The evil creature said as she pushed her captive harder into the bark of the tree.
Now I am going to make you that which you hate so much,
she said as she opened wide her mouth, revealing a set of razor-sharp fangs. Quickly the older man pulled a sharp piece of wood from under his long coat and thrust it deep into the chest of the evil woman. She screamed, mostly from surprise, thinking she had her prey. She could almost taste his flesh, but now watching him fade away as her own body formed into dust and blew into oblivion with the cold breeze of the night. He quickly turned to continue his run in the direction he had first heard the soft music playing. He could see a little better now. There it is, a cabin way out here in the middle of this dark forest. The snow crunched underneath his feet as he pushed towards the small shack. He could see smoke coming from the chimney, warmth, something he desperately needed. He made his way to the door, a flicker of a candle shone through the closed drapes. Someone must really enjoy their privacy to take up a residence way out here, he thought as he stepped onto the porch. His energy was all but depleted as he lifted a hand to knock on the wooden door. There it was again, the music like the same he heard before. It stopped as soon as his fist pounded on the wood. He could hear the floorboards creaking as the owner walked closer to the door. The door slowly opened. He had to admit he was a little surprised at the man on the other side. He was very thin, a long, hollow face, a slight grey beard covering his thin, sunken cheekbones. He was dressed in a tattered smoking jacket, but his hair was neatly combed front to back, showing a high, prominent forehead. "How may I be of assistance to you, sir?" the man asked as he took the stranger by the arm, catching him before he fell to the ground. "Here you go," the cabin owner said as he set the traveller down in a big chair that was placed in front of a roaring fire. "From whom have you been running, sir? You are not a convict, but perhaps a hunter of sorts," said the owner.
"Excuse me, sir, but why do you suspect I am running from anyone?"
the traveller said, pulling off his gloves to warm his hands in front of the fire. "Well, aside from the obvious, the knees of your pants are very wet, indicating you must have either fallen or were pushed to the ground. Your boots are scuffed, showing signs of dragging the ground as well, as if you were perhaps running or at the very least stumbling. The flesh on your face bears a distinctive mark, like that of tree branches, as if you might have pushed your way through some dense forest in trying to hide for some reason or another. And, of course, the obvious. You were out of breath and exhausted when you found your way to my doorstep," the owner said as he sat in the chair opposite the traveller. He pulled a pipe from a pouch that was placed beside the violin that the traveller had heard earlier.
"And about the hunter... why do you suspect me a hunter?" the traveller said, with an understandably curious tone to his voice. Aha, yes, you are definitely a hunter, but of another kind, perhaps. Maybe not of the four-legged beast, but of possibly man. A bounty hunter, maybe, with the unusual weapons that are fastened to your belt. I would say you are very crafty in your art as well, the cabin owner said, now lighting his pipe as he concluded.
Well, that's pretty good, stranger. May I ask your name?
The traveller said, glaring at the man as smoke rolled from the bowl of the wooden smoking utensil. Oh, please forgive me, how rude. My name is Holmes, Sherlock Holmes, he said, extending a hand.
You have got to be jesting me, sir. Tales of your exploits have reached all over the world. I just thought you were a figment of Dr. Watson's grand imagination.
Holmes laughed a bit.
I do have to admit, Watson does have an imagination indeed, and some of the stories have been embellished a bit, but I am very much real, Holmes said with a chuckle. Now, friend, do me the honour of your name, Holmes replied.
My name is Abraham Van Helsing, he said as he took Sherlock Holmes' hand to shake.
So, Mr. Van Helsing, what brings you so far into the wilds of the wilderness on a bitter night such as this?
Holmes asked as he puffed on his pipe.
Mr. Holmes, the things in which I am about to reveal to you are so fanciful and outrageous that I wish I could not believe in them myself, Van Helsing said as he leaned in a little closer to Holmes.
Well, trust me, my dear fellow, I have heard and seen just about all there is to hear and see in my lifetime, Holmes said as he listened intently.
You are right, Mr. Holmes. I was running, and I am a hunter. However, the things I hunt are so foul and evil that I myself wish they did not exist. I would rather be able to retire to a secluded place such as this and live out the rest of my days in solace. But as long as these foul things plague the earth, I cannot find rest, said Van Helsing with all the intensity he could muster.
Please continue, Holmes said, still listening and puffing on his pipe.
Well, sir, they are called vampires,
Van Helsing said, now relaxing a bit, seeming as though a heavy burden had been lifted, as he eased back in the big chair.
3 years ago I killed their dark lord, an evil vampire named Count Dracula, and ever since that night his followers have been trying to get me, Van Helsing said as he looked down at his hat that his fingers were nervously fiddling with.
But why would they bother? Other than revenge, of course, Holmes said as he leaned over and stoked the fire.
Well, once I killed Dracula, I took his remains and hid them away, fearing that somehow, someday, someone would find the way to resurrect the evil demon and loose him on humanity once again.
Holmes was now sitting back in his chair, his long, thin fingers interlocked under his pointed, bearded chin.
And that is how you wound up on my doorstep. His followers were looking for you and chased you here. But they have one less follower to hunt after you now, do they not?
Holmes asked, staring at the hunter.
Yes, but how do you know that? Asked Van Helsing.
My dear fellow, you are covered in ash, and it has a faint smell of flesh to it. I suggest you get cleaned up. I will put out some water on to boil, Holmes said as he pushed himself from his sitting chair to his feet.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Holmes,
Van Helsing said as he rubbed his hands together. Please, just Holmes will suffice, Holmes said as he picked up his water pail.
Chapter 3.
Inverness-shire, a small farming community. Everyone knows everyone, families are close, and when one hurts, they all hurt. When one is happy, they all rejoice, and when a stranger comes into town, they all know that as well. They have been travelling companions for years now, both men wanted by authorities all over Europe. They were not always friends, in fact they met for the first time as enemies. It was almost 5 years before this night. One was running through the darkened forest as townspeople with lit torches chased after him. Oh, he was not afraid of the people of the small village that gave chase. It was not fear at all that caused him to run. It was more of a sport to him. The other one was terrorizing a small village and running amok, drinking and fighting. His face bore a horrible disfigurement. Most thought it was due to some terrible accident he had suffered, but no one dared inquire about it. In fact, most of their assumptions were almost correct. Both men were the same, and yet very different, and on the night they first met it was a battle for the ages. One was definitely a monster who was also a man. The other was a man who was also a monster, and the night they met was talked about all over the little towns far and wide. One was once a brilliant doctor, gifted in his chosen profession. He could heal with the right doses of medicine, and he could perform surgeries that would marvel the mind. That is, until he stumbled upon an invention, a secret, in fact, that lay stored within his own laboratory.
He was searching for a way to remove remorse from the human conscience. He wanted to live outside of the confines of morality and still not bring blemish upon his good name. In creating such a potion, the well-renowned Dr. Henry Jekyll disguised his own appearance using modern chemicals and named his unholy creation Hyde because it truly hid Dr. Jekyll away from the world. In the beginning, the formula did nothing but transform his appearance. He still had complete control over his faculties. He was fully aware of what he was doing as Hyde, but as time grew longer, Hyde started becoming something else altogether. Hyde became separate each time Jekyll took the potion. His own conscious mind was pushed to the back, making room for something else, until Hyde finally took over completely. In the end, everyone thought Jekyll, or Hyde, was dead, but in reality he devised a plan and disappeared, but the papers read only of his demise. Hyde seems to grow stronger now. The doctor changes at times automatically. It just happens sometimes when an emotional response occurs. Just simply hunger can trigger it. So now he has to keep running, trying and working on a cure, before Hyde completely kills Dr. Jekyll, and is the only one of the two that remains. Barry Collins was a hard-working family man. He loved his wife and kids. His family was his whole world. That is, until late one night after a party that his boss of 15 years was throwing at his estate. Larry, his wife, and kids were attacked and killed, all of them, killed on their way home that night. At least that's the way Larry remembers it. They were riding home in their modest carriage when out of nowhere a wolf leapt from the trees and onto the top of their carriage, tearing it wildly. Larry leapt from the driver's seat to confront the monstrous beast. The beast easily grabbed him between its jaws, shaking Larry like a small doll between its teeth, and in the process took a piece of Larry's arm, causing Larry to fall from the top of the carriage, tumbling behind in the dirt as his family rode off without him. When Larry opened his eyes, he could see the wagon overturned just a few blocks away from him. Part of his carriage lay scattered all around. Larry staggered to his feet, looking around for his wife, screaming their names in vain, trying to get a response, but nothing came, until he saw his children lying on the ground. Their bodies had been ravaged by the animal. All he could do was fall to his knees and cry out. The realization that his shoulder was still a gaping wound sent a pain through his body like none he had ever felt before. He fell on his side and watched as his world faded away as he passed out. He could smell dirt, fresh dirt at that. It had its own sort of smell to it. He never noticed it before, but now it was more evident for some reason. Larry tried to open his eyes. They felt like they were fastened shut. He finally forced them open one at a time and tried to see, but there was nothing but darkness all around. He tried to move his arms, but he felt confined. Twisting his body, he came to realize he couldn't move. The space in which he lay was much too small for his frame. The first change occurred in that small space. He first felt the pain start from his shoulder, extending from the attack mark the beast had left him. It moved into his neck and then his head. His focus became clear, almost as if he could see right through the darkness himself. That's when he noticed the wooden box in which he was laying. His arms and legs began to contort and grow larger. He felt a great pain in his face as the shape of an animal began to replace his own human one. Eventually, the animal began to completely replace the much smaller Larry Collins. Once all of the pain subsided, he felt a power rushing through his veins, the likes of which he had never felt before. The animal had completely taken over and was clawing at the entrapment. The wood started to shatter and splinter into pieces. Dirt began to fall in on him, but the animal was determined to get free as he kept clawing and growling. He felt the cool rays of his mother, the moon, as he dug his way to the surface. He could see her full and in all her glory as he burst from his prison and scanned his surroundings. He let out a blood-curdling howl that sent the night birds fleeing from their nests. Dr. Jekyll met Larry for the first time in battle. Mr. Hyde and the werewolf. The werewolf had been in a small village where he found a pen full of fowl. However, the townspeople had gathered together to kill the beast. Mr. Hyde had long since left London, fearing the entire city had been looking for him, so in order to escape he faked his death and left. Dr. Jekyll still had a small amount of control over Mr. Hyde at that time, but not much any more. On this night, however, he had even less. It was then that he first locked eyes with the wolf.
"My, you are a big pooch," Mr. Hyde said in a growl.
The wolf froze and stared at the disfigured man, blocking his only escape from the angry mob.
"Made a bit of a mess in town, did we?" Mr. Hyde said in a mocking manner as he glanced behind the wolf, seeing the torches coming up the hillside.
The wolf just stared at the big Mr. Hyde. Mr. Hyde was somewhat larger than the average man, standing approximately 6'9". His muscles were well defined, even through his pressed shirt. His black hair hung down past his shoulders and rested on the small of his back like a lion's mane. His appearance seemed to change the more he took control of Jekyll. The right side of his face seemed to get a little lower than his left. One eye appeared to be larger than the other, but none of this seemed to affect his confidence at all.
"Oh, I am sorry. Am I interfering with your escape?" Mr. Hyde said, again with a chuckle.
The beast, acting on pure survival instinct alone, lunged for Mr. Hyde. Hyde was also a man of instinct. He grabbed the wolf by the throat as it bounded towards him. Twisting his large body, Hyde flung the beast, using its own momentum, into a large tree, causing bark and debris to go flying.
"Oh, come on now, Pooch. You got more than that in you, don't you? A big tough beast such as you can do better," said Hyde as he again mocked the wolf.
He walked towards the fallen animal slowly. The beast rolled onto its feet, still glaring at Hyde, and now appeared not to care at all about the villagers coming up the hillside, but only to get even with Hyde. He leapt again, this time as Mr. Hyde reached out to grab the beast he missed. The creature twisted its body, almost overshooting Mr. Hyde altogether. The wolf, barely grabbing Hyde by the shoulder, sent him backwards. Both beasts went sailing back into a large pile of bushes that covered a hefty drop-off that went at least 50 feet straight down into a lake below. The lake carried both creatures far out of town as they continued their fighting most of the way. Dawn came, and as the sun shone over the mountain range, Dr. Jekyll's eyes began to flutter and eventually open, looking around, still in a daze. A few thoughts of the night events were on his mind, but not many. Looking around, he could see the lake. His clothes were still wet and much too big for him. He felt traces of Hyde still lingering inside his head. He could tell Hyde was starting to lose complete control. Jekyll stood to his feet, surveying his surroundings, when something caught his eye. A man lying in the bushes. He was almost completely naked except for his trousers, which were nothing more than shredded material.
"Excuse me, sir, are you okay?"
Jekyll said, shaking the man awake.
Yes, I think so," said the man as he rolled over.
The water's sand was stuck to his face as he rolled on his back.
"I did not hurt you last night, did I?" asked Larry Collins.
"No, I am fine. Come, we need to find you something to wear,"
Jekyll said, helping Larry to his feet. The two men had become friends by day and enemies by night. They agreed to stick together. They figured that at least they could have someone with the same circumstances as travelling companions. Whenever the threat of a full moon happened, Larry was immediately given a sedative by his friend Jekyll. Larry, who in turn returned the favour and did the same when Mr. Hyde wanted to make an appearance, keeping both creatures at bay until Jekyll could find a cure for them both. Both men hiding from authorities, all the while Dr. Jekyll studied and feverishly looked for a cure for lycanthropy. They cannot settle in any one place for long, always moving, looking over their shoulders, building a very unusual and an unlikely friendship. They struggle just to survive. Chapter 4. The door was locked tight, but that did not slow the silent rider as he easily pushed the door from its hinges with very little effort. The traps that shot wooden spikes at the powerful being did little more than annoy the dark man as he pressed forward. The stakes stuck into his hollow chest where his heart once set beating, but had long since ceased. He easily pulled the wooden spikes out of his chest as if they were nothing more than poison-tipped splinters.
"We must be close. This is a lot of effort on someone's part to keep out intruders," said the dark man's masked companion.
The dark rider never uttered a word. He just kept moving forward, knocking down doors and defusing traps. He carried a large double-edged sword that made his job just a little easier. The old tomb set in the heart of the Hungarian mountains, just on the edge of a small fishing village. The cemetery had been long forgotten by most men, and these two were very far from their home. One of the travellers is from Paris, the other from a small town in the Americas called Sleepy Hollow. The American was once a great Hessian warrior, that is, until his decapitation. His existence would be impossible to explain. He travels without a head, and yet he seems to see, hear, and knows everything that is going on around him all at once. He has no known weaknesses, nothing slows him from his missions, except one thing. The one that possesses the Hessian's head controls this dark rider. Eric had been found wandering the streets of Paris after his beloved opera house burned to the ground. He barely escaped with his life through underground tunnels and channels. His employer found him half dead from burns and exhaustion. Half of his face was covered by an old broken porcelain mask that helped disguise his hideous face that he bore since birth.
"It cannot be too much further," said Eric, wiping the sweat from his brow as the two men pushed through the large cobweb-covered halls, trying to reach their destination.
It was freezing cold outside, but the deeper the two men travelled into the tomb, the warmer it had become. The final door was by far the largest. It was obvious to both of these dark travellers that this place was never meant to be penetrated. The Hessian took four good swings of his mighty sword before the door showed any signs of giving in. The fifth swing knocked the giant door off its hinges and into the large dark room. As it fell, a large black cloud full of acid blew into the air, sending Eric ducking for cover, while the headless Hessian stood not moving as the acid covered his black cloak. He stepped into the darkened room with a confident stride. No candles were lit, but then again what need of light did the headless man have without a head? The horseman just seemed to sense the things around him, almost as if he had an unseen ghost head that replaced his own. Eric, however, was much more cautious. He was cursed with being immortal. Eric's eyes began to focus. He could see that the room looked empty.
"Something is wrong," Eric said as he rushed past the headless Hessian.
The room was indeed empty except for one urn that was placed in the middle of the big open area in the centre. It was surrounded by cloves of garlic.
"This must be it," Eric said as he pushed the garlic aside, pulling a vial from underneath his long black coat.
He overturned the urn, spilling ash into the centre of the floor.
"Stand by, my friend,"
Eric said, looking at the big Hessian, who stood emotionless. Eric proceeded to pour the vial of a red liquid into the centre of the ash. As soon as the liquid made contact with the ashes, it began to boil. Once the entire vial was empty, Eric leapt from his kneeling position and stopped at the side of the horseman. From the darkness, a figure began to form. The ashes seemed to extend first the chest, then all of the parts that surrounded it began to take shape. Seemingly from nowhere, a man leapt from the ground with a loud roar, grabbing Eric by the throat and pushing him against the wall.
"Who are you?"
the powerfully built man said as he held Eric in place. His grip was like iron, and Eric could hardly breathe, let alone talk. The newly revived man felt a hard pull on the back of his head as his feet left the ground. The horseman grabbed him without warning, and since the newly resurrected man had no clothes on, the horseman grabbed his hair, sending the nude man flying backwards. However, in an instant he was gone, disappearing into a thick fog, only to appear a moment later beside the horseman.
"I have never seen the likes of a being like you,"
the mysterious apparition said. The horseman quickly turned toward the being, and in another instant he was gone again.
"I have been the count of all that is undead for longer than either of you have walked this earth,"
a voice said from out of nowhere as it echoed through the darkness.
"We were sent to free you from your bonds," Eric said as he rubbed his sore throat.
"Sent? By whom?" asked the count in a thick Hungarian accent as he appeared once again before the two strangers.
"Someone with a vested interest in Count Dracula," Eric said as he stepped toward the count.
Chapter 5 Budapest was cold this time of year. It seemed the snow fell constantly. The rooftops filled the air with thick black smoke from fresh fires blazing away.
"I would like my money so that I may be about other ventures, if of course it is all the same to you, madame," asked a very dignified man as he adjusted his monocle and twirled his extra long and pencil-thin moustache.
"Mr. Lupin, you have done even better than my expectation of you, let me believe," the lady said as she stirred her Earl Grey tea. "You have travelled all the way to Egypt and brought me back the sarcophagus of one of the greatest rulers who ever lived, then travelled to the Americas to get me the head of an unstoppable Hessian, and then you have achieved what most thought to be impossible, retrieving the notes from Dr. Frankenstein himself. You truly are the greatest thief the world has ever known. However,
the lady said as she sat in a chair in front of the thief for hire.
I may continue to need your services, she said, taking a sip of tea.
I understand, Madame Bathory. However, the things in which you are dealing will cause a storm the likes of which I do not want to be present for,
Lupin said, also taking a sip of tea.
Allow me to tell you a story, Mr. Lupin. A story of a young countess who was betrayed by her own people and condemned to die alone, locked in her own home. This countess was taken from her chambers, shoved into a tower of her own palace, and as if that were not insult enough, she was then made a prisoner by having the doorway sealed with blocks, floor to ceiling, and for what? All I wanted was freedom, and to live forever. Now I ask you, Mr. Lupin, is that too much to ask for? She said, staring at the gentleman thief.
Well, I can see your point, Lupin said as he swallowed hard.
How did you manage to escape your imprisonment?
Lupin asked, quickly taking another drink of his tea.
That is a whole other story, she said as she stared into her cup, as if her mind was starting to go back to another time at another place. War was inevitable with my people. An army everyone deemed unholy wanted to claim all of the surrounding lands as their own. After my imprisonment, the whole world, it seems, was looking for monsters, and I was considered the worst. There was word of a horrible tyrant, the people named Count Dracula, Dracula meaning son of the devil. He had inherited his kingdom from his father, whom everyone called Dracul, meaning the devil. Both were evil, sadistic men, but the son, Dracula, was much more evil than his father, so much so he gave up life to choose death. And he began making his own army of dead people, the living dead, or as some called them, vampires. Well, the war reached my land, and I remember the castle shaking from some sort of explosion. The shaking was enough to loosen the mortar that held my prison wall in place, and it collapsed in, and I found my way out, so I took it. However, not before seeing the war that was taking place just outside and before my very eyes. It was unlike anything I had ever seen before. There were creatures with wings flying everywhere, killing anything that breathed or moved, and behind it all was the man called Dracula. He did eventually win the war, and he settled into his castle years ago, and nothing was heard of him for years. That is, until he found the woman he loved and left his home to pursue her, and was killed by a vampire hunter, Bathory concluded as she sipped another drink of tea. So now you understand, Mr. Lupin. It has taken me a long time to get where I am today. The world thought I died long ago, and I prefer to keep it that way. Once I revive Dracula, then I will have everything I have ever wanted in my life. Eternal beauty and eternal life, she finished, setting down her cup. But why all the monsters, like the one in the basement? How do you expect to be able to control these things? Lupin asked.
Mr. Lupin, please, that is enough questions for today. I will see that you are paid, and I do expect you to be available should I need your services again, she said as she reached into her lockbox on the table beside her chair.
Here, Mr. Lupin, this is more than our agreed-upon price. Now go, and should I need you again, I will send for you.
Lupin stood and took the money. He placed his hat on his head, took the Countess's hand, and kissed it gently.
Of course, as you wish, my lady, he said as he turned to leave.
The basement of the old castle was, to say the least, a living horror show. There were all manner of torture devices hanging from the walls and the ceiling. In the middle of the room, where the stocks once sat, was a long medical table holding the weight of a giant man.
"Can we really do this, Doctor?" asked Griffin as he stood by a big heavy machine with lights constantly flashing.
"If my calculations are correct, and they always are, I have followed Dr. Frankenstein's notes to the letter," Professor Moriarty said as he peered at the giant created beast. "It is truly a shame that such a brilliant mind had to die, but his creation will live on," Moriarty said. "Do you have the injections?" Moriarty asked Griffin as he held out a gloved hand.
"Yes, of course,"
Griffin said as he removed the bandages that covered his invisible face.
"Here, let me know when you are ready for the spark,"
Griffin said, handing the professor the injection needles. Professor Moriarty was believed to be dead by the millions of Dr. John Watson readers. The professor fell along with Sherlock Holmes from a cliff. Holmes escaped the fall with only minor cuts. The professor suffered a bit more, with a broken wrist, two broken ribs, and a fractured femur. He almost died on those watery banks.
He made his way into a small village where a certain lady was hiding from authorities, pretending to be someone she wasn't. It was there that the professor crawled to the back door of her hut, and she alone nursed him back to health. And it was during that time that she told him of her plans and the story of her exile. Then and there, Moriarty vowed to assist the Lady Bathory in her conquest for revenge. He himself wanted to stay hidden to the world, realizing that his revenge would come, but it would take years, and being a man of intelligence, he had tremendous patience. The professor helped locate most of the Countess's treasures, such as the Frankenstein monster, the tomb of Dracula, and even found Griffin, who the world had known as the Invisible Man. The man only known as Griffin is, like the rest of the Countess's employ, believed dead. He was working on a fantastic experiment into invisibility, where he tried it on himself and it worked. The only problem was he could not reverse the effects. He actually had long since retired when his aide had taken over the project. It was in fact Thomas Marvel's body that was killed and revealed itself to the police upon his death. Griffin had been living quietly in the mountains for some time when he happened upon a battle of two great beasts. One was a giant of a man, the other a wolf. Griffin was mesmerized at what he saw. However, once the villagers spotted him by way of empty clothing standing in the bushes, they assumed he was an apparition and turned their focus toward him. Then and there, the legend of the Invisible Man was reborn. He was quickly discovered by the professor and brought on board because of his brilliant scientific mind. He would be of value, especially in reanimating a monster. In fact, a monster that they both traveled to a frozen wasteland to claim.
"I am not quite sure this will work, Professor. This creature has been dead for quite some time," Griffin said, standing by the giant machine.
"Yes, I know. Ever since the first experiment failed, you remember the one involving that creature we discovered in the Black Lagoon. However, we have to succeed with this one," Moriarty said as he began injecting the creature with fluids. "Stand by the machine," Moriarty said as Griffin positioned himself to throw the switches. Moriarty finished the injections and pulled a watch from his pocket. "Okay, now throw it," Moriarty shouted with excitement. Griffin quickly threw both switches up, and the machine came alive before their very eyes with lights and sounds.
Chapter 6. Van Helsing could see the wooden box sitting in the corner of the room. He nodded to his companions as they stepped forward to remove the lid of the coffin. Van Helsing was an observer, watching as the two men slew the most murderous fiend who had ever lived.
"Now that Dracula is dead, my friends, scrape up his remains and I will take them to a place that no one will find them," Van Helsing said as Quincy quickly scooped up Dracula's remains and placed them in an urn. "Very good, now I will take them where no one will ever find this evil fiend." The loud crashing noise tore Van Helsing from his deep coma-like sleep. On reflex, he jumped from his little cot that normally served as the bed for the great detective Sherlock Holmes. Van Helsing grabbed his crossbow and tore open the door leading to the small inner sitting room. Holmes had given up his bed for the extremely worn-out vampire hunter, and he had taken a chair in front of the fire. Van Helsing knew in his gut something happened, because the whole cabin shook from the noise that awoke him so violently.
"Holmes!"
shouted Van Helsing as he ran into the sitting area where he had left Holmes only a few hours before.
"Oh, dear Lord!"
Van Helsing uttered as he stood gaping at the giant hole in the wall that had once been Holmes' dining area. Van Helsing threw the front door open and ran outside into the night and onto the porch of the small cabin.
"There you are, Van Helsing,"
said an evil voice from a monstrous vampire that was floating 10 feet above the ground, held up by flapping its huge wings, making a thunderous sound as it did so. Once his eyes adjusted, he could see Holmes dangling in the air in front of the monster, held up by his throat. The monster held Holmes up against its own body, using Holmes as a shield against Van Helsing's dead-eye crossbow.
"Go ahead, Van Helsing, you must shoot this foul creature," Holmes demanded. "You cannot let it continue to pollute humanity,"
Holmes said, but trailed off at the end of his sentence due to the crushing force on his throat. The creature's eyes widened, and at that same moment it lost its grip on the detective and he fell to the ground. Van Helsing had not grasped what had happened exactly. He did not have time enough to draw his cross when the creature shouted,
"The master lives!"
and with those words took straight off into the night sky. Holmes gathered himself as he pulled his old body off of the ground.
"Did you hear that?" asked Holmes, bringing himself up to his feet. "Yes, Dracula lives. They found his remains. I was so careful. I set traps, but somehow, someway, someone got to him," Van Helsing said with a panic-stricken voice. "I have to go."
Van Helsing said, turning back toward the cabin.
"Wait, I am going with you," Hans said, following behind the vampire hunter.
"I cannot in good conscience ask you to do this. This will interrupt your retirement. I have brought enough misfortune to you, my friend,"
Van Helsing said, turning toward the detective.
"Nonsense. Besides, I do not have the strength to repair that hole that beast left in my house anyway. So let's make haste. The game is afoot," Hans shouted, pushing past the vampire hunter and darting into the cabin to make himself ready.
Holmes immediately walked over to the wooden trunk that sat at the end of the bed. He opened it and reached in, and pulled out a nicely folded plaid Inverness coat and flung it over his right arms, then sliding his left arm in. He then took out an old deerstalker cap, untied at the top that let the side flaps fall so he could keep his ears warm in the cold night air.
"Okay, I have a carriage behind the cabin," Hans said, rushing out, pulling a drawer open on his desk and pulling out his revolver and dropping it into his coat pocket. Then he immediately rushed out the front door. Holmes threw the barn doors back, revealing two nice thoroughbred horses and a small carriage.
"Grab the horses, I will make ready the carriage," Holmes said, rushing inside. The darkened alley hid all sorts of evils, as Dracula sat trying to gather the thoughts in his head. Being dead for an evil being is not pleasant, and being whipped back into life, well, that's even worse.
"Who is this person you say brought me back?" Dracula asked Eric, as he stood watching the city street.
"She was a countess, in one lifetime anyway," the phantom said as he looked back at the vampire.
Dracula's body was weak from being torn into reality. His mind was jumbled. The adrenaline he used to make himself into fog back at the crypt was now gone.
"Where has the headless one gone?" asked the vampire as he wrapped the cloak around his half-covered body.
"He has gone back to wherever it is he goes, until we need him again," Eric said as he remained watchful.
"My body is weak. I need sustenance," the vampire said.
"What is that sound?"
Eric said at the sound of what seemed to be thunder, but it was a constant noise. It was followed by screaming and the sounds of running footfalls in the streets.
"My children have come to me,"
Dracula said as he stood looking toward the sky. He shot a glance toward Eric.
"Tonight we feed. Tomorrow we meet this countess in which you speak," said Dracula, as the sky began to grow dark with the bodies of the giant bat-like creatures.
The creatures began dropping in an alleyway around Eric and the vampire. The streets were quickly filling up with the evil monsters, all of which began dropping to one knee.
"My master, you are alive,"
one of the creatures said as it bowed low to the king vampire.
"Yes, my children, I am, and tonight feast and drink until you are content," the count said.
Then his glance turned toward Eric.
"I have no need of you anymore," the vampire said to the phantom as he grinned to show two large fangs.
Eric immediately drew his sword along with a wooden stake.
"I have brought you back from the grave, and rest assured I can send you back,"
Eric said, full of confidence. The vampire turned and lifted his arms.
"We no longer hide, children. Go and feed."
As soon as he said these words, the beasts all left the ground, grabbing humans from the streets.
"You and you,"
Dracula said, pointing a finger at two of the creatures that remained standing in the alleyway.
"Go and bring me the head of Van Helsing and the Harkers, and everyone else that aided in my demise," he said, lowering his arm.
"Yes, my master,"
the two evil creatures said as they flew high into the air.
"Now, masked man, what was it you and I were discussing?"
the vampire said, looking back at his new masked prey.
"We have to get to the tomb where I placed the vampire, but we will need a boat,"
Van Helsing said as the carriage raced down the old dirt path, cutting through the darkness.
"I have an idea. I know of an old ship captain that frequents a tavern in town,"
Holmes said as he pushed the horses through the cold, dark night. The carriage made its way into the street of the small village. The town appeared to be deserted, as most places were shut down at this hour of the morning.
"Actually, we might have to find his ship instead,"
Holmes said as he looked at all of the darkened buildings.
"What on earth is that noise?"
Holmes asked as he looked up toward the night sky.
"Get into the thicket,"
Van Helsing said as he reached into his sack for his crossbow. Holmes raced the horse onwards to the outer edge of the town.
"Oh, good Lord, here comes another carriage right for us,"
Holmes shouted as he tried to turn his team. However, the other carriage had the same idea. Holmes felt the carriage wheel lift the ground as it started to overturn. He leapt as fast as his 60-year-old body would let him.
As his body twisted in midair, he could see one of the creatures had a hold of the carriage, manhandling it like it was a child's toy. Holmes landed hard, but he had fallen many times before, and he knew how to land without much injury. He rolled onto his back after coming to a stop. He could see the other carriage had also been overturned. Holmes could hear Van Helsing's bow let loose an arrow. As he got to his feet and made it around the upturned carriage, Van Helsing had exhausted his crossbow and was now at the mercy of the female vampire.
Van Helsing, do not worry. The master does not want you. Only your head, she said with an evil hissing voice. But first, I just want a little taste, she said as she opened wide her mouth.
Her eyes dimmed all at once as if someone had turned a lamp off behind them. Her mouth dropped open with a look of surprise as her head rolled from her shoulders to the ground.
Hola, señores. May I ask what on earth was that creature?
Said the Spanish nobleman as he held the bloody sword which he had used to save Van Helsing's life.
A vampire, and there is another one around here somewhere, of that I am sure, Van Helsing said, standing to his feet.
Immediately he pushed a stake through the heart of the vampire.
The heart is the only way to ensure the creature's death,
Van Helsing said, looking at the elaborately dressed Spaniard.
Thank you, sir. Your timing could not have been better. I am Sherlock Holmes, and this is my associate, Abraham Van Helsing, said Holmes, walking up to the Spanish nobleman with hand extended. The Sherlock Holmes, I must say, I have read of your exploits, even in my former home of California, said the nobleman. Oh, please excuse me. My name is Diego de la Vega, but please call me Diego,
Diego said.
Sir, what brings you all the way out here? Holmes asked as he looked Diego over. Retirement. I promised myself I would see as much of the world in my later years as I could, but I never imagined I would find such creatures as this here, he said, looking at the pile of dust that was once a monster.
Diego de la Vega was of a noble breed. He attended the finest schools abroad and returned home, and after Mexico's War of Independence he settled down when his people were under suppression by Spanish rule. So he disguised himself as Zorro to protect his people, and he fought for years on their behalf until the Mexican army finally won over his homeland and pushed out the Spaniards. Once Zorro was no longer needed, he began to travel the world over. Now a man of nearly 70 years of age, he was as healthy and spry as ever.
I am sorry, but we must be heading back to find the leader of these creatures before this epidemic spreads throughout the world, Van Helsing said. But, senor, your carriage is badly damaged. Come, we will take mine, Diego said with his fox-like grin that usually adorned his face.
Chapter 7 In Venetia was dark and quiet for the two travellers seeking solace, but could hardly find any. One sits asleep, given an injection to calm him into a deep coma, the other sitting at his desk, writing, when the sounds of screams coming through the thin walls caught his attention and interrupted his thoughts. Dr. Jekyll ran to the window to see what the commotion could possibly be about. As he threw back the curtains, he stepped back in horror as he watched large creatures flying through the streets, tearing people from their homes. People who were sound asleep were now wide awake and facing a living nightmare.
"Dear gracious, what on earth is happening?" Jekyll said, turning from the window to make sure his friend was still sleeping.
He heard the glass shatter, then hands upon his shoulders as he was pulled backwards into the night sky. He had spent years trying to suppress Mr. Hyde, and so far he had pretty good control over him. However, tonight for the first time he needed his alter ego to be loosed, if only to save both Larry and his own life. He closed his eyes as the giant claw-like hands clutched him tight, breaking the flesh beneath his clothing as it dug its claws into his shoulder. It flew higher into the air. He did not know if he could summon Hyde or not. In the beginning it took a potion, but of late Hyde just seemed to happen. The creature started to feel the weight of her captive changing. He was getting heavier, as had never happened before. Looking down to examine its prey a little closer caused the monster to turn loose of Dr. Jekyll, as his appearance seemed to be changing right before the vampire's very eyes. His arms began to swell to 5 times Jekyll's normal size, ripping the shirt sleeves to shreds. As his face contorted, his hair grew to shoulder length. His weight became too much for the flying creature to hold as the monster decided to let loose of its catch. Hyde quickly grabbed the flying beast by the arm.
"Well, are you a nasty-looking creature?" Hyde said, pulling hard on the vampire's arm.
The creature let go once Hyde's huge fist began pounding hard on the vampire's abdomen. The streets below were filling up with people running from their homes in terror. When Hyde hit the street, some of the cobblestone cracked under his enormous weight, but Hyde was unhurt as he peered around him to witness the chaos. He glanced up at the window from which his alter ego was pulled and witnessed one of the vampires entering the open hole that was left in his room.
"I wouldn't mess with him if I were you," shouted Hyde with a chuckle. "On second thought, wake the old flea bag up and let's have some real fun," he said as he stood to his feet.
Larry lay quiet and sleeping sound when the vampire entered the room. The vampire had already transformed himself into its human form, curious as to this one and why he was not running in terror like the rest of the cowardly humans. He approached the sleeping man, drawing his sharp fangs from their resting place, making more of a sport with this one than the others. He drew closer to the helpless man. When he reached his vulnerable neck, he sank his teeth deep into Larry's neck. Larry's eyes flung open as if they were spring-loaded. The moon in all its fullness shone in on him. The vampire immediately recoiled and spit out the blood it had started to consume.
"You're not human!" the vampire shouted.
The scent was not human at all. The vampire jumped to the ceiling and sprouted his wings. Larry raised straight out of the bed, his arms and legs contorting. It had been years since the beast was set free, and now it felt good. The howl was loud enough for all the vampires terrorizing the little town to stop and take notice. Moments later, a vampire came tearing through the wall of Larry's room, making the hole much bigger. The werewolf clutched onto the flying creature, tearing at his shoulder and neck like a rabid dog. The vampire, not being able to sustain the weight of the wolf, especially with the wolf's claws tearing at one of its wings, they both hit the ground, which only caused more panic in the streets. The vampires all stopped to look at what they had unknowingly unleashed. Hyde stood in the middle of the streets, a smile covering his deformed face.
"Okay, Pooch, it's chow time," he said as he grabbed one of the vampires and began to pound on its head.
The wolf sprang high into the air, grabbing another winged creature, dragging it down to the ground.
"Enough!" shouted a voice from above. At the sound of the mighty voice, all of the vampires ceased and backed away from their victims.
Dracula floated down toward the streets as if on a cloud.
"You cannot be serious. A freak and a dog? That is what is holding up my army from destroying every living thing in this town? We are vampires!"
"Excuse me," Hyde said as he approached the vampire. "I resent being called a freak," Hyde said as he drew back a fist to hit the leader.
Dracula was much faster than Hyde. He caught Hyde's hand in mid-punch. Hyde had fought many men, but the grip this vampire had was much stronger than anything he had ever encountered before. In fact, it caught Hyde off guard. Dracula instantly drew Hyde in close to his body. "You and your mother are of no use to me," Dracula said as he flung Hyde over his shoulder high into the air. Hyde came down hard through the trees, catching every branch on his way down. Then Dracula turned his attention to the wolf.
"And what of you?" Dracula asked as he looked towards the sky.
"Tear the wolf apart," Dracula said as he vanished into a fog.
Deep inside his mind, Larry knew the situation in which he was placed. Dracula had unleashed an evil apocalypse on everything that stood in his way. And Larry was no exception. He knew he could handle two, maybe three vampires at once, but not an army. Jekyll was violently awakened at the sound of his friend's howls. He tried to pull himself to his feet, but his body hurt badly. He looked above him at all of the broken tree branches. His face still showed the scarring from the fall.
"Hyde, what have you done?" Jekyll thought as he made his way to his feet.
He could still hear his friend growling. As he made it to the clearing of the town street, he could see it more clearly. The vampires were flying and tearing at his friend like animals tearing at a deer carcass. Without fear for his own well-being, Dr. Jekyll ran to his friend's aid. Chapter 8
"Turn off the machine!"
Professor Moriarty yelled. Griffin had done as he was told, and once again the machine fell silent. The professor immediately listened for a heartbeat by laying his head on the creature's chest.
"Well?"
Griffin asked impatiently. The creature was once created of beauty. His hair that was once long and black and flowed with breezes now was almost gone due to sub-zero temperatures. His teeth that were once described as pearly white were now rotted and breaking away. The extreme coldness gave the creature a bluish tint to his flesh. His eyes were sunken inside his head. They were dark. His lips were like two black slits. His nose was misshapen from the years of abuse before his death. Now another mad scientist sought to revive the thing dubbed Frankenstein's monster.
"Father!"
came a loud scream from the belly of the beast. The professor and Griffin both jumped almost out of their clothing. The monster pulled hard in the bonds that held him.
"Easy, you are among friends,"
the professor said as he approached the confused monster. Giant arms pulled hard against the restraints. The sound of leather tearing filled the air. The professor took two steps back and turned to Griffin, but he had already left a pile of clothing on the floor while disappearing into his invisible state. Professor Moriarty could feel the hot breath on his neck. He knew the monster was now free, afraid to turn and face the creature, not knowing what state the monster's mind would be in.
"Why have you brought me?"
the monster began, but stopped as if he forgot the words.
"Why have I brought you back?"
asked the professor, now turning to face the confused monster.
"Because I can make you human,"
Moriarty said, placing a hand on the confused monster's face.
"I will be your father, and you will be my son,"
said the doctor as he looked into the eyes of the beast.